This is an ABC podcast.
Perhaps the most revolutionary development of recent years has been that of the computer, because for the first time, we've discovered a machine that can substitute, at least in part, for the human brain. And they are constantly getting better, cheaper, more versatile, capable of doing more things, so that we can look into a future when, for the first time, humanity in general will be freed of all kinds of work that's really an insult to the complex human brain.
The late great science fiction writer Isaac Asimov.
Leave all that to the computer, and we can leave to ourselves those things the computers can't do. Such things as imagination, creativity, fantasy, intuition, problem solving, where we have an intuitive feel for what the solution ought to be. No computer can do that.
Asimov died in 1992, before the modern internet and the massive advances we've seen in artificial intelligence. He also, of course, preceded the problems we're now so familiar with, the destructive side of social media, things like deep fakes, and the development of semi-autonomous weapon systems. His fame today, particularly in technology circles, rests not just on his science fiction writing, but on the three laws of robotics that he penned midway through the last century, when robotics was still in its short pants. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. Now today on the show, we'll go beyond Asimov in a feature interview with Frank Pasquale from Brooklyn Law School. He's a leading thinker on artificial intelligence and the law. His new book is called New Laws of Robotics, Defending Human Expertise in the Age of AI. And it builds on Asimov's original ideas to create a set of guiding principles for how artificial intelligence should be developed and when AI development should be checked. Frank Pasquale, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Anthony. Great to be here.
Now, you talk in your book about understanding what you call the critical distinction between AI, artificial intelligence, and IA, intelligence augmentation. Explain that distinction to us and why it's important.
The artificial intelligence goal is often to replace human beings, to create, for example, a robot doctor or a robot teacher. And the intelligence augmentation goal is to help human beings. And we can think about this as, you know, a program or software or other modes of analysis that would help a doctor or teacher be better at their jobs or in any job. And the stakes are very high, because if we go for an artificial intelligence vision of replacement, that's going to create a jobless future in many areas. Whereas if we emphasize intelligence augmentation, that should actually increase both the productivity and the value of labor.
So the intelligence augmentation approach, it's about reframing our understanding of robotics and what it can offer society. So does it take away the dominant focus on economics and computer science?
Yes. One of the ideas of the book, and I think of intelligence augmentation generally, is to look at what type of society do we want to create? Not just think that we are in the hands of mysterious technological forces and economic forces, but to say, hey, wait a second, we can actually step back and try to decide what type of technology we want, where we want to invest, where we want to make investment harder. And I think that's a big part of the vision, is to bring politics and society back in.
And many people won't be familiar with this idea of intelligence augmentation, but it is happening already, isn't it? I mean, a lot of the apps that we use, a lot of the systems that we use do adopt this approach.
It's true. And to, you know, work from my own field of law, there are all of these journalistic stories that say, hey, watch out, lawyers, there's going to be a robot lawyer, or all of your legal needs will be met by an app on your phone. And that is a really unrealistic vision. But the positive side of it is that out of that vision, you do get a lot of apps that are routinizing basic tasks, so that, you know, the busy work is less a part of people's lives. And you're seeing some efforts to create better legal research. And I think that that could be true in any profession. You know, in any profession, you could see possibility for intelligence augmentation and software to get rid of more busy work and to make the parts of the job that involve, you know, real cognition, real judgment, a bigger part of the job.
Okay, let's now talk about the new laws that you're proposing. But before we do that, here's a reminder of Isaac Asimov's original three laws of robotics.
One, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. 2. A robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. 3. A robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law.
So they're the famous Asimov laws from way back in 1942. As I mentioned, you've added 4 more, which I'll now get you to outline for us. Let's start with 1, which is robotic systems and AI should complement professionals, not replace them. Why the emphasis on professionals?
I think that in many areas of the economy, you are going to see very rapid automation. Manufacturing, we've already seen that for decades, that the type of methods used in manufacturing are going to be increasingly in logistics, transport, and there are some other areas where you're going to see rapid automation. I think that when you have jobs that involve more judgment and education and deliberation over choices, that's where it becomes not just hard to automate, but a bad idea to automate and to put robots and AI in there. And the idea of the professions, that's a rough and ready division. The professions not only are hard to automate, but ought to be, because in areas like teaching, medicine, a lot of professional fields, you want to have people be able to explain options to their clients, patients, students, other people they're serving, rather than having some large tech firm just sort of assume what is best and automate the result, be it a class, a treatment, or things like that.
Is there a danger, though, that blue-collar workers will feel like they've just completely been abandoned?
There is a danger, and that's one reason why part of my vision is to create the opportunity for everyone to be part of a profession. Ultimately, the goal should be creating lifelong opportunities for education in response to, say, redundancies and an ability to take on new roles. And so there's going to be a lot of transition and a lot of difficult transitions for many folks. And I saw this personally in my own family. My father was a steel worker and, you know, later took on a retail job, you know, and I've seen that type of transition in my family be a difficult one. But I think it is one that we can, as a society, make easier. And part of making it easier is to invest in people and to emphasize that everyone can have some role in society that involves work with judgment, with their expertise being valuable to that work.
Your second law is robotic systems and AI should not counterfeit humanity. What does counterfeit entail in a world where machines and systems are regularly being developed to undertake tasks that once done by humans?
Well, one of the things I really worry about in the future of robotics and AI is robots that try to convince people that they have feelings. So you might come up to a robot that, say, is managing a flight, and you may want to have a certain seat to sit next to someone, and the decision may be made by AI that you can't. And if you try to make an appeal, the robot may look really sad at you and say, well, you know, you're really hurting my feelings. And to me, that is a form of deception. It's a very troubling form of deception because the robot doesn't have feelings. And even to the extent that it could be said to mimic feelings, that could be programmed otherwise. So it's a form of fakery. And my worry is that I like the word counterfeiting because I feel like if you have a society where money is being counterfeited, real money loses its value. If you have a society where AI and robotics are faking human emotions and human interactions, then those also lose value. Those also just become part of this more generalized sense of, are people faking or not? Is there deception or not? So I worry a lot about that. And that part of the book, that law, in large part, goes to my critique of affective computing, where people are trying to create AI and robots that supposedly have emotions or that try to manipulate our emotions. And I think that that's a very dangerous road to go down.
And how would this rule handle, say, automated personal assistants like Siri and Alexa? Do you see them as being manipulative in that kind of way, in the way that you're talking about?
They certainly can be. And I think that the future of human-computer interaction is going to involve a lot of tough judgment calls about how far can, should the robotic assistants try to make it like a sort of seamlessly personal interaction? And to what extent should there be some friction and some level of distance that emphasize that, look, this is ultimately a machine, this is a search engine. And if you think about this film, Her, it involves someone falling in love with the operating system of their phone. Like, imagine someone falling in love with Siri. I think that film really showed, it dramatized how deceived and hurt someone could be when they find out that, oh, it turns out that the operating system I fell in love with has 6,000 other people that it's talking with in the same way. And I think that that same sense of disappointment, that's a good cautionary tale that should lead us to be distant from our tools. Never to think of personal assistants as our partner or as a coworker, but only think of it as a tool that can be used for good or bad purposes.
And language is important here, isn't it? Because you even argue that we need to be mindful of using terms like social and caring when we're talking about robots.
Absolutely, yes. And what I think is so fascinating here is that I think part of the work of the deception and the fakery here relies on people's failure to be careful with the use of words. So, for example, with robots that are sometimes being designed to care for the elderly, I think that, you know, of course, part of it is the word care has many meanings, and, you know, but I think that when we think about care as having some sort of personal connection, they may well be designed to simulate care, but it's not care itself. And also, in referring to robots, you know, I resist even novelists or fiction writers calling the robot like he or she or like a person. I think that it should always be the pronoun, because I think that it sort of denotes the fact that this is a machine and is not a person.
Your third law of robotics clearly relates to military developments. It's that robotic systems and AI should not intensify zero-sum arms races. Could I get you to detail that for us?
Yes. One of the big worries that I have in the development of robotics, both for the military and for policing and law enforcement purposes, is that they are going to lead to a spiral of investment, right? I mean, once one side decides we need to have insect-sized killer drones that can immediately swarm and attack our enemy, then you've got the other side saying, well, I guess we need our own drones to be able to attack their drones, and vice versa. And I think that this type of arms race that we've seen in military spending among rivals in many areas also could be happening in AI and robotics. As soon as one side invests in it, then the other side feels it has to invest. So I think we have to, you know, very early on say, how do we get societies to recognize that this is destructive? It's not providing real human services. It's just sort of investing in an industry of destruction. And I think that goes even beyond the military. I think it goes even to many forms of security or law enforcement, that the investment in these technologies of control are not really meeting human needs or advancing human welfare. They're just finding ways to entrench current power relationships.
And the activities of companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon, I mean, do you see this law also applying to the media world?
I do see it applying to the media world, because I think that a lot of the, one of the things that the book really emphasizes that I think is a truth that's beneath our nose, but that, you know, is rarely really grappled with, is that the most advanced forms of AI and automation in terms of their success at taking over a field are in media. And if we think about how much the Facebook, Google, other algorithms, or we could talk about the Chinese internet firms in their sphere of influence and other firms in other countries, how much these firms have taken over the role of judgment of editors, publishers, others that used to be sort of trusted gatekeepers for news and information, and it's largely automated. And to me, but one of the reasons why it's automated is because those firms have been so successful at setting up arms races for attention, both among advertisers and among users. So, for example, with Google, you know, it used to be you could clearly distinguish between organic and paid results, and most of the results were coming from outside of Google. Now the concern is that, like, they're making it so many of their own results are appearing on the front page, people have to bid more and more money just to reach their audiences. And same could be said for Facebook and other, and the way Amazon runs its platform and internal marketplaces. And so taking very seriously the forms of technological dominance and monopolization that happen when one powerful company can set up arms races among everybody on it, I think we have to use this law of robotics to fight back and think about better ways of structuring our media environment.
And moving on to the final law, which deals with transparency. Robotic systems and AI must always indicate the identity of their creators, controllers, and owners. This is really about humans taking responsibility for the systems that they develop, isn't it?
It is. And I think it has two levels to it. And I think one is relatively pedestrian and straightforward, but I think the other could be quite controversial in the field. So the pedestrian idea is just that, just like cars have license plates, any sort of drone or sidewalk robot or robot that's, you know, roving around a hospital or any place should have some sort of tag on it that could very quickly and easily identify its owner and controller for anyone that, say, points their smartphone at it. And I think that's so critical, because it just worries me immensely that there are so many shell corporations out there that are moving around money irresponsibly and undetectably. And I would hate to see what has happened to our financial sector, which is now so opaque and so conducive to illegal activity, happen in real space if robots start to sort of be wandering around and no one knows who owns what particular robot. It also has a more futuristic bent to it, though, because, you know, there's all this dialogue now about artificial general intelligence and won't it be scary when we are sharing a world with robots that are autonomous? And I think that that is ultimately a really bad vision and that we should never allow robots and AI to become autonomous. Instead, they should always be controlled and owned by a person. And this law, although it seems like a relatively straightforward thing, put a license plate on every robot, actually will help us to avoid future scenarios where there are robots and AI that just are acting autonomously of their own accord. And it's important because, you know, we know how to punish people. We don't know how to punish robots or AI. And that's really important to the future of legal enforcement.
Now, I can hear technologists saying that limiting the development of autonomous systems would cruel innovation. How would you respond to that?
I think that it will definitely put some restraints on many forms of innovation, but the many forms of innovation are bad. I've been researching in the field of political economy and law, and you know, if we look to even mainstream economists like William Baumol, he pointed out that many of the innovations that make things cheaper also make pollution cheaper, make harms and violence cheaper. And so therefore, we have to think very deeply about directing innovation, and innovation itself can't just be a watchword to stop regulation.
Professor Frank Pasquale from Brooklyn Law School, and he's our feature guest on Future Tense today. We're discussing his new book, New Laws of Robotics, Defending Human Expertise in the Age of AI, which builds on the original three laws outlined by sci-fi writer Isaac Asimov. Frank Pasquale, you point out in your book that many people have come to accept the idea that AI development is somehow part of our evolutionary trajectory. How do you alter or break that way of thinking?
It's a great question, because I think that the first step toward altering or breaking it is to get people to understand that that is really a form of metaphysical or religious thought in the guise of an evolutionary thought, or scientific thought. So when people say, well, we are going to get outcompeted by machines, and the only way to create a future where we advance is if we merge with machines, or if machines basically take our place and in a singularity vision, take over the world after us or from us. And I think that that's just a vision that is ultimately, it's based in philosophy and theory, but it's not something that's dictated by any reality. I mean, the core teaching, I think, of evolution is that the reason why human beings, as opposed to all other life forms, are so successful on the planet Earth is because we can work together and act as a community and politically. And in that role, we can restrain innovation, and we can say that, you know, we actually don't want to create a world where humans are competing directly with machines for resources and for affection and for all the other things that make life worthwhile. We can actually stop those forms of competition. And once you stop that form of competition, then that stops the evolutionary trend toward machines.
It's going to be hard, though, isn't it? Because it's part of... Well, it's part of science fiction, it's part of the way we think, it's part of the way journalists particularly and technologists talk about technological development.
It will be hard, and it's true, it is part of many compelling, interesting science fiction novels. But in the last chapter of the book, I also point out some science fiction, some literary fiction, other forms of art that create visions of a future where this doesn't happen, where we're not just sort of in a race with machines and machines ultimately win. And, you know, I think you can see that in Cixin Liu's Three-Body Problem. I mean, that trilogy is fascinating because it's incredibly wide-ranging and expansive in its vision of the future, but human beings are durably the main actors. They're not supplanted by robots, despite all the rationales that one could think that could happen. And similarly, Ian McEwan's novel, Machines Like Me, wonderful novel, sort of envisioning a future where we have to make a very difficult decision about keeping humans in control of robots and not sort of letting them roam free, imitating or impersonating human beings. So I would call for more attention to and more development of arts and literature that envisions human beings durably in charge. And I think that's just as exciting and interesting a story as robots taking over.
In terms of regulation, and there is a popular belief among technologists that regulation should follow innovation, that we shouldn't be preemptive in deciding how technology should be regulated, that it's better to wait for problems to identify themselves and then be targeted in how we address them. What's wrong with that line of argument, do you think?
I think that that line of argument made more sense when technology was less powerful and when pressing existential global problems were less pressing. For example, with respect to AI and robotics, I think now we've seen so many fields where technological advance has led to very troubling and harmful consequences like global warming, that we've got to get ahead of these things. I mean, we can't just sort of look at something like global warming and say, well, you know, we'll just get a technological fix out of it. That's just, I don't think, very realistic, or to the extent it is realistic, it's so disruptive. And so that leads in turn me to think that, you know, we've got to switch these things. And the law is not just, you know, about coming in and cleaning up the mess after technologists create their advances. Law and policy are about directing us towards certain advances and away from more negative ones. And I think we've seen that, you know, for example, with nuclear weapons. That's an example I go into in some detail in the military portions of the book. Even though there are many, many countries that have the technological capacity to develop nuclear weapons, only about 9 or 10 have them. And that, I think, is a success in terms of directing technology in various ways, even at a global level. And I think could stand as an example when we think about potentially destructive forms of AI and robotics that we want to curb.
You argue in your book, The New Laws of Robotics, that the optimal mix of robotic and human interaction is far too important to be determined only by corporations and engineers. US policymakers in particular have shown themselves to be reluctant to regulate technology development over recent decades. Is that beginning to change, though, do you think?
Definitely. It's starting with big tech. And it's interesting to see both very big shift in the US, in Australia, and in China with respect to large tech firms that are leading much of this AI development. I think that when I was writing about this stuff in the 2000s, you know, over the beginning of my career, I would often get the pushback where people would say, we don't want people like you killing the goose that's laying the golden eggs. And I think now, like Google, and, you know, I had someone at a talk who say, don't you mess with my Google. And I think people are saying the same about AI, and we're saying the same about AI and tech. And I think now that we've seen just so many negative consequences coming out of these firms and the monopolization and the squeeze on small and medium-sized enterprises and the internal self-dealing and things, there's a sense that just as the finance sector had to be reined in after the great financial crisis in 2008, that the tech sector has to be reined in and made more accountable to public values now. So I do see that change. The House Antitrust Committee in the U.S. had a fantastic, you know, 500-page report on the future of competition there. And, you know, taking responsibility for economic outcomes and for pushing the technologies for the public interest, I think, is going to be a bigger and bigger part of government platforms in the 2020s.
It occurs to me that because of COVID-19, the crisis there, that there appears to be, at least in many countries, greater social acceptance for governments to once again play a more hands-on role in guiding and developing not just economies, but societies. Do you see that as a positive thing? I mean, does that augur well for effective technology regulation?
I think the COVID-19 is a very fascinating crossroads, because I would compare the response of South Korea and Taiwan and Australia, incredibly successful government-led responses to crushing the virus, with a sort of techno hope that I see in a lot of the U.S. So, you know, if you look at the examples of South Korea and Taiwan, are the ones I'm most familiar with at the present, there was really incredibly strong government leadership to say, we've got to work together societally as a whole to fight this as a community. And I think perhaps Australia is, with respect to Victoria, it was particularly fascinating because there were hundreds of cases a day, and that was brought down to zero. And so that's really heartening to see that sort of social response and community and government-led response. Meanwhile, in the U.S., I was just looking at the Washington Post homepage, and above it was an ad from a pharmaceutical trade group that said, science will bring us back to normal. Here comes the vaccine, right? Or there will be a vaccine. And so there's one group that I think is very powerful that would say, don't worry about government's regulatory ability and ability to lead. We can just have science and technology will save us from anything that, you know, happens to be threatening us. And I think a very different approach is to say, we as citizens have to be flexible enough to accept the authoritative leadership of experts, epidemiologists, public health experts, government experts, in working together to combat threats. And we need to lead a technology as opposed to assuming technology is going to lead us to various places. So it sets up amazing dichotomy, a fascinating dichotomy. And hopefully, you know, the best of both will be appreciated on both sides. Hopefully that, you know, the US and Europe will learn something from the Australian and East Asian response to COVID. And some of the technology developed in the US and in Europe with respect to the vaccines will help make it so that it's easier to deal with these diseases in the future.
You say in your book that, and this is the quote, we can uphold a culture of maintenance over disruption, of complementing human beings rather than replacing them. That relies, doesn't it, as you've just been saying there, on we the people not only recognising that there's a problem, but also being motivated to do something about it. And yet, in many ways, we live in an age of passive consumption, don't we? It sounds like you're confident, though, that we will eventually find the motivation to act.
Yes. You know, I think it probably will take some massive disruption. So in terms of, like, with the self-driving cars or just a mass adoption of, say, retail kiosks, I think then when you have not just hundreds of thousands, but millions or tens of millions of persons facing redundancy, then that's going to hopefully climb up in terms of the political salience. Of course, there's always the temptation to blame foreigners, blame outsourcing or other things for job loss. And I think that's got to be combated, you know, and the question has to be, how do we all take responsibility for our technological future as the political frame, rather than who do we blame for bad things that are happening? And that's going to be tough because in many places, you know, the populist energies are going to be all about blaming some other. Often it's a foreign other. But I think that the real challenge will be, can we find political leaders that can articulate a vision of we as a people taking on responsibility and saying, here's how we're going to develop the future of human services to bring in an inclusive prosperity, to bring in as many people as possible to play important roles in serving one another.
And just finally, I mean, why take the approach that you've taken with this book? What convinced you that what was needed was to build on Asimov's, quite basic in lots of ways, three original laws of robotics?
You know, I saw in the Asimov laws of robotics a lot of resonances with the current debates over universal basic income versus job guarantees. So Asimov's vision, I think, it reminds me a lot of the universal basic income folks, the UBI folks, who say, look, ultimately, we're going to have a cornucopia of services and goods produced by technology. And our role in society is just going to be to sit back, relax, find ways to have fun. And, you know, what will we do with all the free time? And I connect that to Asimov because he's sort of assuming that there's this robotics infrastructure out there and it's there to help human beings and not harm them. And that's basically the goal. And my sense is that actually, as technology and AI robotics develop, there's going to be a huge number of value decisions to make about what kinds of goods and services we get. And we've got to have human beings in control of that. So whereas Asimov is talking about how do we have robots help people and not harm them, I'm talking about how do we democratize to the greatest extent possible the direction of technology and the direction of where we're developing it. And so I thought it was a good sort of, both a good foundation, because Asimov's very interesting writer and, you know, well known, and has those are good ideas. I don't disagree with those laws, but it's also a good foil because he's really, to my mind, assuming a certain technological trajectory that it's going to take a lot of human input and expertise to make legitimate.
Frank Pasquale, Professor of Law at the Brooklyn Law School and author of The New Laws of Robotics. We appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great speaking with you.
And the book is published by Harvard University Press. That's our show for another week. My thanks, as always, to colleague and co-producer Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.